Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Podcast on the Brink, your weekly dose of Indiana basketball news and discussion, brought to you by the Assembly Call and Inside the Hall. I'm your host, Jared Morris. Join me live at assemblycall.com every Thursday night and immediately following every IU game for our live IU postgame show. And visit InsideTheHall.com for complete coverage of IU basketball and to join the discussion in the Inside the Hall Premium Forum.
Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of Podcast on the Brink. Unfortunately, Jared is not going to be with us this week. He had some things going on. And so I'm going to be joined this week by a special guest. One of my good friends and somebody I think I've known as long as anybody on the IU beat. We go back to his time as a grad student at IU. Zach Osterman of the Indianapolis Star. Welcome back to the show, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm trying to hit mute on this microphone so you don't get the background noise of my cavernous office playroom here. But it's good to be back.
So a lot obviously has changed since we last saw IU basketball in March, and we're living in a very uncertain world. I think not just from a sports perspective, but life in general has changed for everybody. I can't think of one person whose life hasn't been impacted in some way by this pandemic that we're all trying to face every day. You know, this is a show about IU basketball, obviously, but from a sports perspective in general, I want to talk a little bit about college sports because this week the Big Ten announced that all team activities are going to be suspended through June 1st. Not a surprise, I don't think, to many people, but what do you think are the next steps? And I know it's, I want to preface everything that Zach and I say on this show with the fact that we're obviously not medical professionals. We're just two guys giving our opinions, and you know, we get asked a lot about, you know, is there going to be a season next year? We don't know, but we're doing our best to try to figure out kind of what's next. And I think, you know, at this point in time, it's really all we can do. But I just want to preface that our conversation with that. But Zach, I'm just curious from your perspective. You know, you cover IU football as well as basketball. And so football is kind of the next big thing on the horizon. From a Big Ten and college sports perspective, what do you think are the next steps here that are going to have to be, or the questions that are going to have to be answered next as we kind of figure out what's going to happen here in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think it's been made pretty clear at this point that the commissioners and, you know, to some extent, the presidents, the chancellors, the provosts, you know, those positions can kind of vary across universities. But those people, I think, have been pretty uniform in the idea that unless they can bring students back, if the campus itself cannot be open to, you know, the general student population, faculty and staff. So to give Indiana as an example, the only people, bar emergencies, that are allowed in Indiana university buildings right now that I'm aware of. And my wife works at IU. She's been working from home since all this started. So almost 2 months now, the only people allowed in are building maintenance. You know, the people who would need to be in there to fix some kind of plumbing problem, keep things clean, whatever. Everyone else is working from home. Indiana, and I use Indiana as the example because it's what I know, it's what I'm closest to. Indiana has been working on figuring out its way forward, probably. Here's where I need to kind of be careful between what's sourced and what's me trying to connect dots. I think that if you want to talk in terms of hard dates, I have a suspicion that unless we see another real explosion of cases, which is, you know, always possible based on what the experts are saying, I have a suspicion that you will see a number of colleges and universities, including Indiana, begin to try and loosen things up next month. So we're talking on May 6th. I think that, you know, that could be sometime in June. That would still probably be limited largely to essential personnel. We've discussed things like maybe she'd work from home part of the week and come in part of the week. There would still be, you know, really sort of strict measures on social distancing. Everyone would be, I don't know if they would be required, but certainly strongly encouraged to wear a mask. There would be a great emphasis placed on sanitation, you know, especially at places where you might enter the building, reminders to put on a mask, stations to wash your hands, those kinds of things. But trying to see if they can't kind of crack the window open a little bit. And the analogy that I've, the best one I've come up with when people have asked is that it feels like all of this from a sports perspective, from a society perspective, whatever, is going to feel a little bit like learning to drive a manual transmission. Like the first few times we do it, it's going to stall. We're going to screw and the engine's going to stall. And then we'll get a little better at it and a little better at it and a little better at it. And by the end of the lesson, maybe we're not driving like naturals, but it's running smoothly, or at least smoothly enough that the car is moving forward. And I think that you're going to have to see that process unfold before you can think in a serious way about college sports, because that's not to say that part of the universities trying to open that window or crack that window open is maybe them starting to think about ways in which they can get some of that back, ways in which they can get, you know, maybe some athletes back on campus, maybe some activities up and going again, though, you know, that's going to be up to the conferences, the NCAA too. But until you see something resembling normal returning to college campuses, you can't really think in terms of, you know, when are we going to see college sports? I think that's the thing that has been made very clear. Now, you know, the flip side to that is, again, I think what will happen is it'll come in waves where we'll try these things. They won't work. At first, there will be setbacks, and we'll figure out how to deal with those setbacks and tweak things and figure things out, and then it will run more smoothly. And then there will be sort of this template that everyone can follow and sort of overlay onto their situation to say, well, this works for us, but this doesn't, and this works for us, but this doesn't. So I don't think it's necessarily something where it's just like, you know, we're going to go back to zero every single time something goes wrong. But I do think that you're going to need to see, you know, life maybe under, let's call it a new normal, sort of resume on the college campuses before you can think very seriously about when can the athletes come back, certainly when can competition begin, and what does that look like from a competitive standpoint, from a travel standpoint, from a fan standpoint, everything.
You know, the thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I don't know that there's even a way to predict on this or kind of look into the crystal ball and figure out how this might be handled. But as we read the news every day, and we know that obviously you live in Indiana, I live in Kentucky, two states that are bordering each other, but two states obviously doing a lot of things differently in terms of reopening. And there's no uniform policy, obviously, right now around the country as to, you know, states doing, you know, they're on different timelines. And so I'm curious from your perspective and kind of, you know, you talk to a lot of people in the athletic department, I'm sure, and How do you think it's going to be managed in terms of a NCAA perspective if you have, you know, certain states? For example, it sounds like we've had a lot of SEC athletic directors, presidents talking, you know, about obviously they want to play their seasons, their football seasons this year. Other states are being more cautious. Who ultimately do you think is going to make the decision on whether or not college football starts on time? You know, let's say there's 25 states that end up with students back on campus, and then you have, let's say, a certain segment that's maybe some online, some on campus, and then you have some learning remotely. To me, that kind of seems like a scenario where it would be helpful to have a commissioner of college sports or somebody that was kind of overseeing to make these decisions, because it kind of seems like you know, we're obviously in uncharted territory, but if you have different states on different timelines and you have, say, SEC schools wanting to play football and maybe some other conferences aren't ready, how do you think that's going to be managed and figured out? Do you have any insight or thoughts on how that could work?
Yeah, I think, not to get too sort of philosophical, but I think one of the things that this has probably begun to expose, and it's not like we didn't know it was already there, but I think certainly one of the things that maybe is going to really become pronounced as we do try to move college sports, because, you know, the thing is, relatively speaking, this is easy for the pro sports, right? Like, you have, like, all of the stakeholders basically live under the same umbrella. And the players have their union, and, you know, the owners have their committees and their meetings and, you know, things like that. But ultimately, it's not hard to get all those people to come together in one metaphorical table and discuss what it would take to get baseball going again, to get soccer going again, to get football up and running, the NFL in the fall. You know, college has so many different stakeholders because, for example, the Big Ten presidents, you know, you talk about, you use a great example there with the SEC. We are seeing, and I'm not trying to be political, but you're seeing a very different sort of public policy tack on all this being taken in a lot of Southern states than you are in a lot of Midwestern states, than you are in a lot of Northeastern states on the West Coast. And so, you know, the conference commissioners are going to think certain things. They're going to probably take a lot of their cues from their presidents. You know, you're going to have the NCAA has tried very hard, I think, and commendably, I would say, and I'm not someone who is always quick to praise the NCAA, but I think they have tried very hard to position a number of experts at the forefront of this discussion, in terms of the committee that they've built and the people they've put on it. I think former surgeons general, you know, people like that. But it all comes back to this issue that I think college sports has had for a long time, which is basically who's in charge. Because, you know, Mark Emmert runs the NCAA. And I think that the sort of lay sports fan would say, well, the NCAA runs college sports. But if you're involved in it enough, you know that really the NCAA doesn't, I mean, in theory, the NCAA only exists at the will of its members. In practice, those members, both in word and in action, really probably more often than in action than in word, will dictate NCAA policy. And broadly speaking, you have seen groups form within that I think, you know, people love to sort of wring their hands at inequality in college athletics, financial inequality, competitive inequality. I'm going to be honest. I think that's always existed. Now, is it more pronounced now? Possibly. But I think it's also just an easy thing to talk about. And it's one of those things that it's very easy for people to feel like the problem is worse in their time than it was in a time they didn't know, in the same way that, you know, I think there is just a human, again, I'm not trying to get too philosophical, but there's a human tendency to see what's going on around you in the moment as the worst thing that's ever happened. Because it is the only frame of reference you have. History books don't feel so tangible to you as having to walk through your grocery store wearing a protective mask. not being able, as is the case with my mother, who lives in an assisted living facility here in Bloomington, I can't go see her right now. You know, is this the worst thing that's ever happened to the world? Probably not. But this is the frame of reference that I have. And I think that when you talk about inequality in college sports, I think the truth is that actually we probably have, it's not perfectly functional. Of course it has dysfunctional elements, but we have at least gotten to this place in the last maybe 10 years where it seems like we have built a hierarchy that does more good than bad, works better good than bad for most people. The Power Five conferences, the Group of Five conferences, you know, the way you stratify certain things in college basketball, and then obviously how all of that filters down to your non-revenue sports. What I think that this is has the potential to really kind of expose is some of the real flaws in that. And I think that you come back to, and I've made this comparison in things I've written before, but you think about what baseball wanted after the Black Sox scandal in 1918. Baseball wanted to clean up its image. Baseball wanted to feel like, you know, people could trust it. And so essentially baseball put a dictator in charge of the league. They put Kennesaw Mountain Landis in the commissioner's office and they gave him, you know, unprecedented power. We can have a long debate about whether or not baseball was better off for it, but the point is that's what baseball wanted. I think that to your point about a commissioner of college sports, I think that I would not be surprised at all if there's a point at which there is kind of an outcry for that, for there to be one, you know, sort of unifying figure at the center of all of this decision-making, who is the person in charge, you know, is the person sitting at the head of that metaphorical table. I just don't know who that's going to be. And I think that we've been in moments in the past with, you know, rules issues, television rights, realignment, certainly, where college sports might have been better off for having somebody who was essentially kind of the czar of college athletics in this country. And we didn't, but ultimately those were competitive concerns in many respects, some of them educational. You know, this is obviously much more grave. And so you just sort of wonder at the end who dictates what the final decision is. I think that that's going to be maybe the most difficult thing for me in terms of beyond the obvious of managing this disease and you know, sort of controlling its spread as much as we can as we move forward. For college athletics, it's going to be basically who is in charge of deciding of the final decision, because there are so many different stakeholders involved that aren't really always answerable to one another. The NFL Players Association and the owners are answerable to each other. Because if the Players Association doesn't agree to play or the owners don't agree to pay, then there's no NFL. You know, college sports is a little more disparate. And I think that I think that's a good point, because I think we could wind up in a situation where you almost do wish there was just someone with almost a level of dictatorial power in college athletics that could just, in the end, let all of the debate happen and then say, I know we disagree on these certain things, but this, in my view, is the best decision, and this is how we're going to move forward.
One last thing on this. It's not exactly the same topic, but you've been writing a lot about football recently because there's obviously been a lot of availability and talking to different players and coaches. What sense in general have you gotten from the football program about what their expectations are moving forward in terms of how much time, you know, they obviously missed a lot of valuable time in the spring. What sense from the coaches and from the players are you getting that how much time they will need to get ready if there is a season, and kind of how has it changed, I guess, the day to day for the football program? You know, basketball, being off campus, it's a much smaller set of people. And it's, I assume, a little bit easier to manage the communication when you're talking about 15 players for football. It's a lot more players. Obviously there's more coaches, but I would assume it's, in football, there's a lot more focus obviously on strength and conditioning this time of year. What kind of feedback have you gotten from the coaches and players on kind of how this has changed things for them, and what kind of timeline would they need to be ready to play if it's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I will say that, and I think this is probably department-wide, I think Indiana University, as an athletics department, has made a real effort to not have a Mike Gundy moment, to not have a moment where anybody kind of did anything other than parrot some very, you know, straightforward, I don't want to say boring, but, you know, kind of by the book answers to questions about, well, when do you think this can come back? And when do you think this should come back? And so on and so forth. And I'll also say too, Tom Allen did, I think, about a 45 minute Zoom call with reporters a couple of weeks ago, but I was on furlough, so I was not able to participate in that call one way or the other. You know, Allen has, I think, at least tacitly endorsed the idea if they could get some, I think his idea was basically sometime in June. If they can get their players back together sometime in June, even though they've lost a lot of spring practice, they've obviously lost all that strength and conditioning time you talked about, then that would be enough time to start the season on time. Now, of course, there's also the possibility the season doesn't start on time. I think ultimately, you know, I've talked to coaches, and not just at IU, but in general in football, I've talked to coaches in non-revenue sports. Even the non-revenue sports coaches will say, you know, something to the effect of, they can do with my sport whatever they need to. Just as long as we have a season, we can play it out of season. We can play it at a different time of year. I don't care. Football's the one we can't lose, because football is such a revenue driver that it would impact deeply everything else in the department. I think that, you know, really, you know, there's a lot of different theories basically on the difficulties football's facing right now, in just in terms of the day to day, and who could benefit and who could lose if and when programs are allowed to come back together. So, for example, right now, football's not really losing much, because this would be the time of year that players would be given off. They could stay and work out if they wanted, but that's completely voluntary. A lot of them go home. You know, Saturday would have been, and I guess still will be, but only virtually, IU's commencement. Spring practice would have ended, et cetera. I think the difficulty for football was back in March and April, when, you know, Indiana had just hired a new strength and conditioning coach. He was in the process of putting his staff together. That would have been an opportunity for him to really dig into his roster. And instead, basically what he was doing is trying to figure out how to write body weight and dumbbell workouts for each one of his players individually based on what kind of facilities they had access to. So, you know, it gets into kind of this idea of, you don't know what kind of shape your team is going to come back in. You know, you could still be having position meetings through spring practice. You know, obviously all of that was being done virtually. Coaches could not monitor any sort of workouts, still can't. Strength coaches can't even really monitor workouts. They can just look at results. And so, you know, what you're really going to have is almost kind of this crash course. And I think what could happen ultimately, if the season is able to start remotely on time, is effectively you basically get two schools of thought for coaches. Coaches that do everything to prepare their players' bodies and just think, we're going to have to dumb down the playbook, we're going to have to water certain things down, but we're not going to break down physically. And coaches who prepare players' minds and almost say, I'll win the tactical battle, and maybe we won't be maximizing our strength and our speed the way we normally would have, but we'll mitigate that with the tactical battle. I could see that with college basketball too, frankly. But I think in terms of what football will need, I think that the uniform, I don't want to say uniform, but probably the most common response that you get when people have asked that question of coaches in the last couple of months is at least 6 to 8 weeks. And I think coaches, Tom Allen tacitly endorsed this idea of basically NFL-style off-season training activities. So when you get guys back, coaches can work with their players. You know, in essence, almost a slowed down spring practice in the summer that leads into preseason practice, rather than, you know, what you and I both know, the way most sports work, which is, you know, in the summer you can work out with your strength and conditioning staff and you might get a little bit of instruction time with your coaches, but most of it the coaches have to stay away from. The idea would be that because of everything that's been lost and because you're kind of having to crash course your roster back together, from a game fitness and preparedness standpoint, that the coaches would just be able to work with the players for an extended period of time in June or July. And I do think that there's going to be an appetite for trying to see if that's possible next month. And that's I really, you know, consider that, I guess, informed speculation, but I do think that's really possible. And then you get into kind of the winners and losers, like a team like IU returns a lot of production. So maybe it's easier for a team like Indiana. Maybe you've got better habits and, you know, because you're returning so many guys who've played so many snaps young, it's been second nature to them to go home and keep working hard and at least come back in some level of, you know, good physical shape. And they've already got all the experience and the reps and the playbook knowledge and all that stuff. But I think it's still, even if, let's say, that these coaches could get their players back, let's just say June 15th, I think there would still be a lot of kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't decisions they'd have to make about getting ready for the season. And then, of course, all of that would be affected by any sort of setbacks or whatever might happen.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
From a basketball perspective, I let some people know on our forum that we were recording today, and so I got some questions. There's some good ideas in here. I'm not going to take them verbatim, but I'll maybe touch on a couple of them. But I think the more, you know, obviously from a basketball perspective, I think the most intriguing offseason storyline to me is whether or not Christian Lander is able to successfully reclassify and come to campus next year. What are you, as the off season kind of moves along here, what are in your mind some of the more intriguing storylines to watch as the summer goes along for IU basketball?
I mean, the Lander win is obviously big. And I wouldn't have cautioned since the day he committed against looking at Christian Lander like some sort of savior. I'm not sure I'd even be completely prepared to look at him the way that I think we looked at Yogi Ferrell in 2012, which, you know, was basically just, you know, the starting lineup has a Yogi Ferrell sized hole in it. And when he enrolls as a freshman, he'll assume that role and we'll just all go forward. But adding a high ceiling, talented point guard to a roster that I think could use another kind of dominant ball handler in addition to Rob Phinisee. An in-state kid who's played with some of these guys before, who's familiar with a lot of their games, who's been to, you know, a lot of IU games, presumably played in some open gyms and that sort of thing. Of course, that changes the calculus for Indiana. You know, I think the other kind of off-season storylines for me, and, you know, these are storylines that maybe we don't get a great kind of look at in real time because we don't spend a lot of time around the team in the summer. Obviously, right now the team's not even around itself, so to speak. But how does Trace Jackson Davis grow? You know, because I think that there is very much the potential there for him to take a leap and be maybe the dominant big man in the Big Ten, certainly one of them. And that's, I mean, I guess part of that is how you want to see Luca Garza. But I see Garza as more of a, I don't want to say a small ball four because he's 6'9", 6'10". But, you know, Trace Jackson Davis and Luca Garza don't play the same position. I think everyone can, broadly speaking, understand that. When it comes to true, you know, down low, dominate the paint bigs, I think Trace Jackson Davis could be as good as anyone the Big Ten has next year. It just depends on the progress he's able to make. I would look at a couple of players that I think, you know, I don't, maybe at least one of them starts, maybe neither of them start next year, but Race Thompson and Jerome Hunter, I think, you know, when you saw the impact both of those guys could make when they were playing well last year, you think about Jerome Hunter against Ohio State and Maryland. You think about Race Thompson the last month and a half of the season. If those guys can both take tangible steps forward, and I'm not talking huge leaps. I'm just talking more consistent, a little stronger, a little bit better defensively, maybe a little bit more consistent at the offensive end and whatever it is they want to try and do, then I think that boosts Indiana significantly because then you start to really get into a conversation about how deep and versatile Indiana can be and how they can attack you all sorts of different ways and they can – you know, they can throw different weird coverages at you and on and on. I think, for example, about the way that Indiana defends Lamar Stevens at home in the Penn State win back in February. And then the last one is just Justin Smith. And I know that Justin Smith is a player that divides opinion for people sometimes, but he was a double figure scorer last year. He was Indiana's joint second leading rebounder. He's been an almost ever present figure in the starting lineup each of the last two seasons. And, it's not likely in my mind that you fill that hole if for some reason he decides to stay in the draft. Now I think there's a broad base expectation at this point that this is a test the water, get some NBA feedback and come back for my senior year decision. But of course, you know, as long as that sort of loose end isn't tied up, that's probably one more for me. So I think those are the three or four big ones. And then of course, you know, Robert Phinisee, how does he keep growing? I think we can all see how important he is to Indiana as a point guard. But those are probably the big ones for me this offseason.
Question that was submitted. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this because the more I thought about it and looked at kind of the depth chart for next year, there's a lot of guys who you look at and say, well, this guy could definitely play a role, but you know, there's two or three guys also at the position that are going to have something to say about it. And you know, how do you think Indiana is going to be able to spread the minutes around to keep everyone happy next season, especially if Lander comes in, because it kind of looks like, you know, they could go 10 or 11 deep. And realistically speaking, it's always nice to talk about that in the preseason, but then when you get in the meat of the Big Ten, you're not playing 10 or 11. You're playing 7, 8, maybe 9 when it comes down to it. I mean, to me, that's one of the interesting things looking at this roster for next season is just the sheer amount of guys who you look at and say, this person could play a role. How do you think that all balances out?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I'm fascinated by the point guard dynamic. If Christian Lander can reclassify, because I don't think, you know, Rob Phinisee is just going to sort of fade to the background on that. But you also can't deny Lander's talent potential. I do think we could see more three guard lineups, or maybe kind of true two guard, one wing lineups than we saw a season ago. You look at the way that last season ended, you could imagine maybe Race Thompson still eating up a few more of Joey Brunk's minutes. And certainly between the two of them, you know, it's worth pointing out down low, Trayce Jackson-Davis is already playing a ton of minutes and you're losing Deron Davis without bringing in another true big. So, you know, the four guys that play those four and five, Brunk, Jackson Davis, Thompson, Justin Smith, I mean, you know, those four, I think there's going to be tons of minutes to go around there. At this point, and of course, I mean, we're talking on May 6th, things can always change. At this point, I don't know that I expect Indiana to fill that 13th scholarship. So that, you know, kind of frees, that loosens certain things up as well. And then I think that this is the other kind of key to recruiting players that understand that they're four-year guys. And that can sound simplistic, but I mean, I remember having a conversation with Anthony Leal. I did a long sit-down interview with him near the end of the regular season. And he said, you know, when I came in as a freshman at South, they needed me to knock down shots. They needed me to be a shot maker. And as I got older, you know, my role changed and I needed to understand how my role changed and they needed me to score more. They needed me to take on bigger defensive assignments, whatever. And he said, and I already know that looking at Indiana, what's going to be my, you know, I need to understand my role next year and embrace it. It's going to be, can I come in and offer something on defense and knock down threes? And the point is, I think that sometimes when you recruit kids that understand that, you know, if they don't play 19 minutes a night as a freshman, that doesn't mean that they're not going to have the career that they want over the course of 4 or even 5 years. You know, it's worth pointing out Archie Miller wasn't afraid to redshirt a guy at Dayton. He did it more than once. Then I think that's when you get into a situation where you can say, hey, we can go 9-10 deep most nights. But as you point out, on the nights where the bench does tighten up, the guys down at the end aren't thinking, well, hold on, you know, where are my minutes? Why am I not getting a look at this? I think, you know, if you ask me, for example, for a starting lineup right now, and it's difficult, but, you know, I'd shooting from the hip, I'd say something like Rob Phinisee, Al Durham, Trayce Jackson-Davis, all locked in. And then I think you can make an argument for, let's say Lander's on the team. Christian Lander starting, certainly an argument, of course, for Justin Smith starting, Race Thompson starting, Joey Brunk starting. So maybe it's also not a year where Archie Miller is completely wedded to his starting lineup. I don't know. And it's going to be difficult in some respects, but I also think too, you know, if you want to be a high major coach, you need to know how to handle this, because, you know, a high major program like Indiana can't only have 7 good players. You know, a high major program can't be in a position where it's only got 11 scholarship guys every single year and only trusts playing 6 of them. And I'm not saying that I'm not, like, that's not a direct criticism of Archie Miller. My point is more saying he has shown that he knows how to recruit the guys that fill a lot of the holes that he has on his roster. The next step is being able to keep, you're never going to keep everybody happy. You're going to lose guys to transfer. That happens. But being able to keep everyone happy enough that you're only losing the guys like DeMazie Anderson, who looks at it and says, you know what, I just don't think there's going to be minutes for me here going forward. I haven't been able to carve out the role that I want. There's no hard feelings. I just want a different challenge. I want a place where I can play more. So part of it also just does come down to, you know, can you coach guys, not just in terms of X's and O's and skill development, but in terms of getting them to buy into what you're trying to do, and getting them to recognize that just because maybe they don't play a lot as a freshman or even as a sophomore doesn't mean that, like I said, they aren't going to get to have the career they want by the time they're done. So, you know, I mean, I think if we presume Christian Lander reclassifies and Indiana does DeMazie Anderson scholarship, then you have 12 guys next year, including 4 freshmen. You at least get the sense that a lot of those freshmen understand, for example, that they'll have to come in and work very hard to play. And if that's the case, then you could have just kind of a situation where those guys look at it and say, okay, maybe I won't play a ton this year, but then next year, Justin Smith and Al Durham, 2-3 year starters will graduate. And then the year after that, you'll lose another couple and on and on. It's not perfect. And I suppose any coach would tell you they'd rather have the options than not have the options. But I think it also just comes down to, you know, are you a skilled enough coach at connecting with your kids and getting to buy in that, you know, you're not at risk of somebody just turning really sour if the rotation shrinks from 10 to 8 in February and March and they're not in it.
From a schedule perspective, I think next year could be as challenging as we've seen in a while in the non-conference, at least. There's a potential, obviously, for the Gavitt tip-off games to be played. And again, this is all assuming that, you know, we play next IU plays next season as expected, but that's what we're operating on under that assumption for this conversation. But yeah, the Gavitt games could happen again for IU. They didn't play last year. They've obviously got Maui on the docket. There's the likelihood that they're going to play the Big Ten ACC Challenge game on the road, Crossroads Classic against Butler, 2 non-conference games that we already know about at home as well, the fall under kind of guarantee game, the guarantee game header with Robert Morris and Nebraska Omaha. Do you think this team's going to be ready to play this difficult of a schedule? It seems pretty, I named at least 6 high majors, assuming they're in Gavitt, which I think
they will host a Gavitt game this year.
Okay. I'm fairly
confident in that.
That's six high major games in the non-conference, which probably I've been asked about, you know, the potential for Kentucky or Arizona. And I'm thinking with what they've already got on the docket, I would say this is pretty much probably it for the high majors. Would you agree with that? And do you kind of see this team being ready to navigate a slate like that of the non-conference?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think the one thing you get when you're Indiana and you, whatever you add as a freshman, if they take a grad transfer to fill a spot, whatever, you've got a hierarchy built in there. So if you imagine, you know, a college basketball season is sort of a lump of clay in October that a coach is trying to sort of slowly shape in November and December and really kind of add fine detail to and January and February, so that when you hit March, you know you've got the whole thing there ready to go. I think the one thing that not always but tends to set teams apart that can have success in November and December is the ability to have confidence in basic stuff that works, so that whenever if ever you wind up in a situation where your game plan is just not working and the coach hasn't gone deep enough into the playbook for guys to understand how to adjust and how to layer on, there's some basic things you can pivot back to. And I think that Indiana is going to have a lot of those things. You know, they're going to, effectively, and I'm not trying to slight Deron Davis, but effectively, you know, they've only lost one significant statistical contributor from last year. And I guess maybe a better way to say that is not so much that they've only lost one, it's that they only have one significant contributor from last year for whom they do not have ready-made replacements. You know, when you look at what Indiana asked Deron Davis to do, it should have the personnel to change a lot of, you know, to fill Deron Davis's minutes. Maybe they play a little bit of a different way. Maybe it's a little bit of a different style, but you get the point I'm trying to make. I think you've got size, which Archie Miller always needs. You're going to have steady point guard play, and more than that, veteran guard play in general, because you got a junior and a senior headlining your backcourt, and you're going to have Trayce Jackson-Davis. And so as much as, I mean, yes, that's a difficult slate, at least on paper. And of course, I mean, listen, we can have a separate conversation about whether events like the Maui Invitational are in some sort of peril ahead of next season or not. But I think that there are already some really sort of foundational, you know, kind of aspects of next year's team that are going to be in place, such that if you run into a difficult night, a difficult opponent, you don't need to necessarily be able to go to, you know, chapter 14 of the playbook to figure out how to out scheme, because you're going to be able to lean on some fundamental strengths, your high low game, your point guard game, the veterans you have, the depth you have, the broad idea that I think it's fair to say this program looks pretty well bought into Archie Miller's defensive philosophy at this point. Offense needs to keep coming on, but defensively, Indiana is very good and probably still going to get better. And so my point is, it's absolutely a difficult non-conference schedule. You can even throw those two Big Ten games in there, presumably, as well, because those are typically played right after the Big Ten ACC Challenge. So you're going to wind up in a situation where you could go basically from Maui Invitational to Big Ten ACC Challenge to Big Ten game to Big Ten game to Crossroads Classic or something like that. But I also think that if you're going to have to navigate a stretch like that, it's no bad thing at all that you've got a team that is as veteran as Indiana and is something that made a lot of sense to me in watching it play out this year was when Archie Miller would talk in November about how his team was young, and he didn't necessarily mean in years so much as he meant in roles. And I sat down and kind of looked at the roster, and it just occurred to me that the only guy at the beginning of this past season who was in theory not stepping into a completely different role from any he'd ever really filled in college was Rob Phinisee. That's not going to be the case next year. You know, the roles that you are asking guys to fill, let's say Phinisee, Durham, Jackson Davis, Race Thompson, Justin Smith, those are going to be roles that are probably maybe a little bit expanded, but probably pretty familiar to those guys. And so if you've at least got some of those fundamental sort of strengths, and maybe the better way to put it is confidence in those fundamental strengths already ingrained into your roster, I think you're okay. Because the other thing that's worth pointing out too is a lot of those teams, you know, I mean, North Carolina, I think, is in Maui with Indiana next year. They're going to have to turn around and play a Big Ten ACC Challenge game. They're going to have two non-conference games in November and December. You know, they're going to have to get ready for the CBS Sports Classic and on and on and on. That's the other thing I'd say too, is not to just keep kind of turning this back to, hey, that's life in the NFL. But You know, you want to be successful at Indiana. You're not looking for free passes in November and December. You're looking for challenges that will harden your team up for February and March.
Get you out of here on this, Zach, but this is a non IU basketball or football question, but it was actually addressed to me in the forum, but I want to ask it to you because I'm just curious and give you a chance to maybe talk about some of the things you've written about. I know you had a big baseball story today, and you know, the one thing I will say is someone that relies on people reading stories and all that, and Zach's in the same position. It's a challenging time just in general for everybody in the world, but for our professions, it's been a different time too. So I'm curious, the question Mark asks is in an odd kind of way, do you find the current situation that we're in from a professional standpoint, have you found that giving you new creative ways to try to come up with content and stories to write? I mean, how has that been for you, and kind of what are some of the things you've done? If you want to talk at all about that baseball story, because I think it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that it has done is it's taken us all out of the daily grind of, you know, I mean, the number of times I said, oh, I want to do this story, or I want to do a series about this or whatever. And, you know, and then I only put maybe 70% of the time into it that I want to, because I only have 70% of the time. I can't give it as much time as I want. I've got to move on to something else. I think we've been able to do that a little bit more. I mean, that, you know, that baseball story, and I can talk about it, the story itself a little bit, but it, you know, in one respect, I covered that team in 2008 and a significant portion of 2009. And I've stayed, you know, sort of like in touch with a number of those guys since. So it wasn't hard for me to find sources, but you know, it also struck me like essentially what it is it's an oral history of the 2009 baseball season, which was the first Big Ten tournament Tracy Smith won at IU. It was a team that had seven guys eventually got drafted off its roster that year. I think 12 players on that roster in total would get drafted at some point in their careers. Obviously, a couple wound up in the pros, Josh Fagley being maybe the most, you know, the most well-known of those. But like when I started spreading around to just, you know, sending some texts and direct messages to some of those guys, one of them, Kip Schutz, just texted me and he said, hey, all the guys are getting your texts and they just want to set up a Zoom call. Do you want to do that? And it just kind of struck me too. This may sound simplistic and maybe I'm wrong, but I just kind of got the sense everybody was happy to talk about something that didn't have anything to do with coronavirus or how this is affecting, you know, schedules or seasons or anything like that. But you know, just simply saying, let's talk about a happy memory you've got. And you know, that story specifically, that team was fascinating. It was it was a team with a lot of character. It was a team with a lot of spunk. It was a team that was not afraid to be a little bit off color, which kind of comes through in the story. And my suspicion is that there's probably even more examples of that they will not share with a reporter on the record even 11 years later. But it was a team that, you know, I guess what was fascinating about it was, and Tracy Smith talked about this a little bit when he and I chatted for that story, it was a team that had no concept of what winning was like. And it was a team there that had to learn how to win almost from nothing. You know, that they hadn't even made, the program hadn't even made the Big Ten tournament until 2008, Tracy Smith's third year. They hadn't even made the Big Ten tournament since 2003. So this was a program with, and they'd only made one NCAA tournament ever in 1996. This was a program with next to no history, tradition, you know, built-in success, any of that. And these guys effectively just kind of had to manufacture that themselves. And Tracy Smith was tough on him because Tracy had that success and he knew what it looked like and he knew what it would take. You know, he drove him hard. And I think that maybe in some respects that almost kind of brought them closer together because they're an exceptionally close group. I think teams, you know, teams always tend to stay together when stuff like that, you know, when they achieve stuff like what that 09 team achieved. But I mean, that group, like I've run into them at a teammate's wedding or, you know, when they've been, not that I've been at the wedding, but when they've been in town for a wedding, and it's never just a half dozen of them. It's never, you know, four or five that were really tight and they're all each other's groomsmen. It's always 10, 12, 15 of them all together. You know, they do an annual cabin weekend somewhere around Bloomington, I think sometime in the fall or maybe early winter. And like they get a dozen guys or more to come back every single year, just that group. And, you know, it's a fascinating story to tell. I think Jeremy Gray, who of course we both know works for the IU Athletics Department, and that season was the first season that IU put on the radio from a baseball perspective. And so it was also kind of maybe the right season in the way that you know, serendipity is always a little bit of a part of success. It was the first time that maybe IU fans could get more unfettered access to games than normal without having to go to Symbar Field. And, you know, here was this spunky, colorful team that hit a bunch of home runs and won enough games to win a Big Ten tournament. And that's the first, you know, it's the right year to be the first year in the radio. But Jeremy called those games, and he said that he said of 2013 and 2014, when Indiana went to the, you know, College World Series, new stadium, national seed, all that, 2013 and 2014 were the Joe Torre Yankees. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second. If 13 and 14 were the Joe Torre Yankees, then in 2009 was the Millie Martin Bronx Zoo Yankees in the 1970s. When there was, you know, it could be a little bit anything goes, no holds barred. It's incredibly off color at times, but it still led to winning and it still led to success. And it was still, you know, really fun baseball. And so we try to tell those stories under more normal circumstances anyway. But ultimately now I think we do have a little bit more time. And you and I both know this would be our off season anyhow. But, you know, now's a time. The other thing, too, is now's a time when everybody's got some free time. So it's maybe also not harder to get somebody on the phone because, you know, for them, I don't know how many interviews. I can't speak for you, but I've done a number of interviews for different stories in the last month where basically someone's just been like, hey, happy to be off of Zoom and just be on the phone with a human and not staring into my computer for 20 minutes. Hopefully we'll get to keep doing this. Obviously, also hopefully, you know, we'll all be able to find a new normal here relatively soon. But in the meantime, I think we have, the opportunity to try and zoom out a little bit, attack some of these stories that we probably wouldn't have made time for otherwise, and just give people, you know, I think people still want to read about sports. I think they, you know, and especially in the absence of live sports, they want to be able to reminisce and go back, and, you know, here's the an opportunity for them to do it.
Absolutely. Well said, Zach. It's, I know we talk every day, so it's not like we haven't caught up in a while, but good to get you back on the show and get your perspective. I really enjoyed your thoughts on just kind of the most fascinating thing to me is this kind of, as we go here, is just figuring out how, because our jobs depend on college sports happening. Obviously, if they're not going to happen for the foreseeable future, then both of us start to kind of wonder what we're going to write about. I think the conversation just about on how all that could work was fascinating, and I think it's kind of the next big thing that we have to look forward to, at least in terms of figuring out what's next for sports in general. So thanks for that, and thanks as always for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's always good to be back.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podcast on the Brink. We always appreciate you being here. Remember to join me and my co-hosts for more IU basketball talk at assemblycall.com, and visit Alex over at insidethehall.com for complete coverage of Indiana basketball. If you want to support Podcast on the Brink, here is the single best way to do it. Tell anyone you know who loves IU hoops about us and suggest that they subscribe. Podcast on the Brink can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else podcasts are available. Tell your social media followers, email your friends, text your family members. For weekly discussion about IU basketball, they need to be subscribed to Podcast on the Brink. We'll talk to you next time. Go Hoosiers.